The Senate Education General Government Committee. We're going to start today with a public hearing on Senate Bill 333. Committee, you'll hear from our administrator that this is an amendment that replaces the entire bill.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of committee, the Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 333 would authorize the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission to issue an informal approval of a license registered or certain certified person under certain circumstances. It provides that the approval shall establish terms of a monitoring person for that person, and it requires the commission to notify the person's employer of the approval. It authorizes the commission to take certain disciplinary actions, and it sunsets on June 30th, 2012, and requires a report to the legislature. And we do have fiscal and revenue statements on the Dash 3 amendments.
Senator Walker, this is your doings here?
Yes, it is, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Chamberlain is my partner in I won't say crime, I will just say in creative talent. This is a bill that I sort of had an idea about it about a year or so ago, sometime in the interim, talked to Ms. Chamberlain about it. We couldn't quite figure out what we were going to do. The original draft that came to me was not good, and therefore I couldn't introduce it as a bill because it was just not acceptable. So I decided that I wouldn't drop it and I would use this bill that I had drafted relating to school reform, which is a relating clause to education, and I have that bill drafted every year so I can use it for just such a purpose. So I would like Ms. Chamberlain to take us through the program that we're trying to create, which I think is really a novel idea. It actually kind of mirrors what the nurses have been able to do with nurses that have had substance abuse problems. And, you know, we've been doing a lot of work on educators and protecting children from educators gone bad. Well, there are sometimes things that educators do that don't rise to the level of losing their license, that maybe they just need a little help like everyone else. So we have drafted this bill, and I'll turn it over to Ms. Chamberlain if I can.
Thank you, Ms. Chamberlain.
Oh, yeah, and I forgot to identify myself. Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7. Sorry.
We know who you are.
I know you do, but not the record.
Ms. Chamberlain, if you could walk us through this and begin with the legal investigation of letter of informal approval and what that means. Is it a fancy way of letter of reprimand or and the ramifications it may carry? And if there's a hypothetical you could give us here as an example.
Chair Hawes, members of the committee, for the record, Vicki Chamberlain, Director of Teacher Standards and Practices. I don't know if we have a precise legal category for letter of reproval. I think it's a very innovative thing for Oregon to do for educators who are usually first-time offenders. And the concept behind the bill is it grew out of a program the nursing folks have for folks with chemical dependency. We actually see a lot of alcohol-related incidents that might not rise to levels of taking action against a license, where people would commit to treatment and turning things around and are often first-time offenders. This would be a perfect time when somebody perhaps has shown up to work under the influence of alcohol, has never done it before, maybe a young teacher, maybe a veteran teacher first time, and you might have some concerns about whether or not they're taking their possible chemical dependency seriously, and you say, this is serious, you should not show up to work under the influence. However, you have a clean record, we don't have anything else going here. What if we do an informal letter of reproval? We monitor it for 3 years, you continue with your treatment plan, and you complete that, and then at the end of that, the commission would dismiss the case. Right now, the commission's options after they finish an investigation is to take action or dismiss. And we've seen some interesting cases where the commission sits right there, and when in doubt, they'll more often lean toward taking action than dismissing. Sometimes it's a young teacher who's lost their temper, and you want to get their attention. Or they're in situations where they just weren't thinking and they've made dumb decisions, but they were quite serious. And an example I can think of is a new young teacher who was provoked by a 17-year-old kid who was in a situation where he barred a door with his foot and finally made the teacher so mad he crawled in a window to get him, and by the time they made contact, you know, everyone was upset. Well, you don't want teachers ever struggling physically with kids. On the other hand, the educator was immediately sorry, took full responsibility, was horrified, but he was fired. So, and often, you know, the district discipline is sufficient too. So, if you had a concern about anger management, then you could say, we want you to be evaluated for anger management. We want to monitor it for a little bit. Looks like you got it under control. We'll dismiss it. If they don't meet the terms, it wouldn't be dissimilar to a probation. If they don't meet the terms of the conditions that the commission sets, then the commission would just take disciplinary action and reprimand them or suspend their license or something similar. So what I like about this is that we've really focused on the awful educators this year, and there's a whole bunch of folks who make mistakes. And this would basically give them an opportunity to start over and not have to have a permanent sanction against their license. Because right now, the way the statute's set up, if the commission takes action, we don't have a way to undo that. And most times you don't want to. But every once in a while, you can look back and go, wow, that's too bad that had to happen in that case.
Okay. In the case of someone who'd been drinking, say at lunchtime, comes back to the school and is confronted by the principal or vice principal, what happens now?
Right now? All kinds of things happen. They're almost always reported to the commission, but not always. If it was the first time, that's a hard one. That's on duty. That's in the middle of the workday. That is not quite the same as somebody who went out for a drink after school and then went to the basketball game or the football game and parents smelled alcohol on them or they acted silly. We did have one situation during an in-service where three teachers went out to lunch and had a glass of wine, and the community saw it, and they called that in. That would be a letter of reproval situation. The commission debated that one for over an hour. They were on duty, but no kids. If you go out to lunch on a work day when there's kids, that's always, I can't imagine, you just have to look at each individual case, but that one right there, it's a little disturbing.
So, I mean, I assume there are rules established drinking at lunchtime?
The actual standard is it's gross neglect of duty to show up, to be under the influence while on duty. So on duty is always part of the issue. So if you're an educator and you go to a school game, we say you're always on duty. If there was a bomb threat, the administration would look immediately for your help, you know, to assist in getting people out or help with students or things like that. So you are on duty when you go back to your workplace. If it's during the workday, it's on duty. If you are you see the away coach decides to have a glass of beer with their pizza at dinner, that's on duty. And those usually always end up with some disciplinary action. If it's a beer at dinner away with pizza, it's most likely going to be a reprimand. But it's permanent.
Mr. Chair, might I add another scenario? I know my husband's employer, they offer counseling for employees who may have problems. Let's say someone gets in a fight with their spouse and their marriage is falling apart. They go out, they drink, they come back to work, they've had a few drinks, or they've done something else. That is when the employer would say, would you like to get some counseling? And they go and they can get counseling and they still retain their job. And we're just trying to find ways. Teachers are human beings. Teachers are just like us. They have a higher level of standards because they're with children. And we've certainly done quite a bit this year to rein in what is acceptable and what isn't acceptable. I just think this is an opportunity for an educator who makes a very small mistake, and this is all defined by rule by the commission, and if they don't meet the terms of their letter of reproval and the terms and conditions, then they get formally sanctioned, and they suffer the consequences.
Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you, Ms. Chair. A few questions, Ms. Chamberlain. Are most of the cases you deal with complaints you receive from parents or the public, or are they coming to you from the schools?
Chair Hawes and Senator Cruz, it's about 50-50. Actually, in the last couple years, the district reports have outnumbered the patron reports. But it is really about 50-50. I don't know if that's any indicator or not, but what Senator Walker made me think about is we have cases where there's clear intent involved when people are engaged in misconduct, and then we have cases where people just weren't thinking, it was unintentional, it was just, you go, that was a dumb mistake, but that was a big, dumb mistake. And they're clear cut almost all the time by the time you're done with your investigation. This gives people one bite at the apple. It would be our version of a diversion.
Yeah, thank you, Ms. Chair. Do you have the ability currently, let's say you get a complaint from somebody in the public who saw something, do you have the ability currently to remand action back to the school to... Let's say it didn't rise to a very high level, and so you remand back to the school to deal with it internally. Is that a current option?
Senator Hawes, Senator Cruz, no, it is not. It is the schools don't have jurisdiction over licensure issues. So how a school action will play into whether the commission takes licensure action is usually in one of these smaller cases. If somebody's been reprimanded by their employer or suspended or put on unpaid leave by their employer, that actually, and it's one of these minor cases, the commission's tendency has been to go ahead and dismiss it. They were dinged 3 unpaid days by their employer. This is permanently in their discipline file. Yeah. At the employment level, we're going to give them another chance. But no, we don't. The commission tries not to be an employment arbiter. Either they have made their misconduct rises to a level where you take action against their license, or it doesn't, and you just dismiss it.
Okay, remand may have been a stronger word than I was looking for. Let's say there's a case where it has been reported to you, the school's not aware of it, it's a minor infraction. Do you inform the school that this complaint has come forward to give them the ability to internally inform the teacher or whatever and say this is that and try to take remedial action at that level?
Chair Haas, Senator Cruz, yes.
Okay.
But we do not, we're not allowed by statute to say, okay, it's over. What we do is when we get patron complaints and we have not heard from the district, we notify the district immediately and we say, have you heard about this? Have you had a chance to do an investigation? And if not, we'll wait till you're done and take that information before we finish our look at it.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the second page, line one, what does that mean? Shall be made available for public inspection upon request, and that refers to the letter of informal approval, I assume.
Chair Hawes, Senator Morris, that's actually fairly significant.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, because right now, legally, while the commission has a case and while it's under an investigation and before the commission takes any action, everything is considered 100% confidential. If the commission takes action to dismiss, everything gets sealed and is confidential. If the commission takes final action to discipline on the license, then it becomes fully public, the file does. What this would do is someone could call up and say, does Vicki Chamberlain have a informal letter of approval with you? Yes, she does. Here's a copy. And so it would, that is what would be made public, is just the letter of reproval and the terms of the reproval.
So as a follow-up,
Senator Morris,
I would assume that's a prospective employer that would be in asking that question. I guess I'm interested in those who need to know should know, but those who don't need to know shouldn't know. It would be like a personnel file in a private employment being open for public consumption, and that just doesn't seem right.
Chair Hawes, Senator Morris, it would just be the letter. It wouldn't be the investigation file, and it wouldn't be everything in the investigation. It would just be the terms of the letter. The way this is written, I think that was in an effort to be as transparent as possible without, you don't want to look like you're hiding things when you're trying to work with someone, I think was part of the thinking on this. Frankly, I think it's going to be requested most often by patrons and reporters. I think that employers are going to be fairly aware of what the outcome is because they would be informed right away. That's the way our statutes are written. When the investigation is completed and the commission makes any decision, we inform the employer. They would know.
Mr. Chair and Senator Morris, this was a point that we talked at length, and I was looking through my file. We've been working on this bill since February. That's why you're just now seeing it, because it just, we nuanced so much of this language because it was so important. We didn't want to hide anything, yet we wanted to give educators a second chance for these minor infractions. And so we felt that if we didn't make that available to the public, if they asked for it, we would have been accused of trying to hide it and shuffle somebody through. So that's why that piece is there. And you know, this is trying to balance the public's right to know with the educator's right to get a second chance.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, it was my suggestion we put a sunset on it so we could see how it worked. So we could come back to you if there were some major problems or even with any data that this is really working. It was hopeful that we'd like to give it a try. I think it would actually benefit the profession.
Well, Mr. Chair, my question was not in the context of I don't like the concept, because I do. I think a step of progressive discipline that can preserve a high quality, you know, large investment person, I think has merit. I do have some concerns about the public nature. I guess if we were looking at the personnel file that resides within the district, would that file be made public?
Chair Hawes, members of the committee, I think now it is. I mean, with the new bills that we've been working on this session, that my employment file follows me to a subsequent employer, which is semi-public. It's not like the community can get into my file, but I mean, to that extent, I think personnel files have been opened more than ever. This was, I think, considered mostly. Let's put it out there that way so it doesn't look like you're trying to hide something after you've worked so hard this session to keep conduct out in the open. So it was a tough call.
Senator Cruz.
Yeah, I'm following on Senator Morris. I guess my concern would be, let's say you have a teacher that says, yes, I have a drinking problem, and part of the action that's being taken is they're going to be doing diversion or treatment or something like that, and that's in these other programs you're talking about, that isn't discoverable. And I'm just wondering if the fact that they are in a treatment program would suddenly be discoverable with this, and that might be a problem.
Chair Haas, members of the committee, right now someone has a serious chemical dependency issue and they're willing to enter into a public settlement agreement with the commission. Part of the terms of their order is that they continue treatment, and that's very public. So the facts of how we got there, that whatever conduct was based on the consumption of alcohol, would be laid out in the facts. The fact that they did it while they were on the job would be the violation in the order. And then the terms of the conditions, if they were suspended for reinstatement, would be that they completed treatment and that we had an evaluation you know, and all of that's actually very public right now.
Ms. Chair, but that's a higher level than what we're talking about here, theoretically. And, you know, so there was a complaint, and they voluntarily came forward and said, you know, I think I may have a problem, and they're, you know, they aren't doing it because of sanctions. They're doing it to try to clean up their own lives, and and yet by doing that, suddenly the fact they're doing that is discoverable may be a deterrent. I mean, it's just... I'm just wondering if that's, I guess, my minor concern here, that if we're trying to do something at a lower level to kind of stave off things, but we're creating a discoverable record, there may be a taint that we aren't necessarily wanting to put here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, but I was going to wait for Ms. Chamberlain to respond.
Frankly, it would be legally easier to keep them private, because if at the end of it ends in dismissal, we're required to keep all of that public private anyway. And I discussed this with Senator Walker. It makes it a little messy where in between you can disclose part of it, but if they ended up dismissing, you wouldn't disclose the rest of it, like the investigation file and things. So legally and procedurally, it would be easier to protect if they weren't public, just so you know.
Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have what I think is a big picture question, and I need help to understand the context of this. Is that the group of teachers you're hoping to bring into this, the problem that you're seeking to address, is it more likely the teachers who right now you would dismiss because it wasn't quite bad enough to put fully through the process, or you would put them through the process in a harsher manner than perhaps you feel they're justified under this bill? I'm trying to figure out if this is going to result in people who would otherwise be dismissed under the current structure, or the other group. Is it people who would go through who now have a lesser sanction?
Chair Haas, Senator Bonamici, it's a great question, and I can easily answer it. If there is no evidence of misconduct, the commission will dismiss. I mean, in other words, there has to be evidence of misconduct, and then you have to weigh, does the evidence, is it sufficient enough to rise to a level of discipline? And so in all of these cases, I think the commission would be debating, do we reprimand or do we dismiss, even though there's evidence of misconduct?
Mr. Chair and Senator Bonamici, I think what you're asking is, do these people get their case dismissed, or do they lose their license or have some harsher sanction? And that's true. Right now, that happens. There's no in-between. And if the commission has evidence, they have to proceed. They cannot dismiss if they have sufficient evidence. So it's very harsh. It's either you didn't do anything wrong and they have no evidence of it, or you did and they're going to punish you in this way. That's what we're trying to do, is find this middle ground for people whose conduct has not risen to the level of losing their license or getting some kind of a formal sanction.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, is there anyone else signed up to speak on this bill? Close public hearing on Senate Bill 333, and we're going to carry it over. Senator Walker, I know that you are sponsoring one of the other bills before us today. Do you want to deal with that?
Yes, right. I would, Mr. Chair.
And I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 43.
Do you want to intro that, Mr. Chair?
Yeah, please.
Senate Bill 43, actually, we have a -1 amendment that we would focus on. It replaces the measure. It specifies that a resident district is responsible for the special education, transportation, and participation in interscholastic activities and other programs if services are provided to a homeschooled child by a qualified private alternative education program. And in statute, this really refers to one specific program known as HomeSource. It specifies that the homeschooled child's parents are responsible for declaring that the child is homeschooled. They have to provide specified examinations and instruction at home. And it specifies that the school district, contracting with the program, shall evaluate and monitor elements of the program. So it's trying to define who has responsibility for these different pieces of education for children attending Home Source. And then it also addresses how children are permitted to attend if they have to have a release. And it requires essentially a release, and it grandfathers from the release requirements homeschooled children enrolled in the program prior to July 31st, 2007, as well as their siblings. And we, let me get this right, do have fiscal and revenue statements as well.
Okay.
And this is from last time, Senator.
From last time.
Yep.
Okay. Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This is my bill file on this bill from last session. This was Senate Bill 619 that dwarfed into or morphed into House Bill 2040 in the final hours of the legislative session down in Ways and Means. This was actually a nightmare and a nail-biter at the end of the session. Many members of this committee are familiar with this case with Home Source. We tried for months last session to work with the Department of Education on resolving this matter short of a bill, looked at making Home Source a charter school. None of that worked, so we came up with the language that ultimately ended up in House Bill 2040. Unfortunately, the Department of Education took a different view of how the bill was drafted and essentially made it difficult for Home Source to continue operating as it had before. They were to be grandfathered in as they had been before, but somehow that didn't turn out that way. I know that one of my school districts is here to oppose this bill. I represent three school districts, and one of my school districts, the Bethel School District, loves this bill. They love this program. They've loved this program from the get-go and have worked very closely with them. One of my other school districts is opposed. However, I will tell you that my other school district's school board voted not to send their children to the Home Source program, which they are free to do. This bill will not change anything about that. So I believe my other school district is protected by their own board, who has made a decision not to refer children to the district. I also, one of the board members of my opposing school district back in 2007 had questioned the constitutionality of what we had done in House Bill 2040, and I sought a legislative council opinion in November of received the opinion in November of 2007 that said we have broad legislative power that is limited only to the extent that the Oregon Constitution limits that power. We can pass legislation that affects only one person or thing as long as the Oregon Constitution does not specifically prohibit that type of individualized legislation. This works. This solved the problem for Home Source, which has been a great program for my community. Some would disagree, but I believe it has been a great resource for members of my community. The legislation was narrowly drafted. Unfortunately, it was narrowly interpreted. And so we are here to fix that problem so Home Source can continue operating. And so at this time, I'd like to turn it over to Ms. Prowse-Williamson, who's the director of the school and can talk to you in more detail about the amendment.
Thank you. My name is Paula Prowse-Williamson. I'm the executive director and one of the founders of Home Source. Senator Haas and members of the committee, I'm here today to tell you that we just want to clean up House Bill 2040 and its interpretation. I am a former school board member. I'm a member of COSA. I have worked with public schools for over 20 years now. I'm the former president of the Oregon Association for Alternatives in Education. I've served on task forces at the Department of Ed, and I'm here to say this program works. The program has been there 13 years, and this year we will graduate the first student who has been at Home Source from the 4J school district since his kindergarten year. I thank you for listening to us. I don't want to go into a whole lot of detail other than the detail that I have is that 4J School District or any other school district that is in the Lane County or any county will not have to send a child if this bill is passed. It keeps local control at the district. It just allows those districts who would like to send students to home sources they've been sent for the past 13 years.
Questions?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to make one additional comment in that the bill was very narrowly drafted last session so that this would not open it up to these alternative schools across the state. Everyone was in agreement that Home Source would continue to exist in its niche in Lane County, and it works just fine. It's my understanding the Department of Education is neutral on this bill, and I know of no other position by anyone else, so I suspect you'll hear from them today.
I did, Senator Haas and members of the committee, I have heard that one portion in the amendment about who the transportation is assigned to is problematic. And if we can get this to the House, believe that the transportation can be assigned to the parent because the students in our program must be registered homeschoolers to attend through this route.
Okay. We have some other witnesses.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I will dismiss myself because I have an appointment outside the building. Have a great Friday and a great weekend. Thank you for your time.
Tom Henry and Lori Wimmer.
Mr. Chair and honorable committee members, my name is Tom Henry. I'm the deputy superintendent with the Eugene School District, and I'm here to speak on behalf of the district today about the amendments to Senate Bill 43. As mentioned in previous testimony, our school district has had lengthy conversations about the original bill, and currently we do not release students to go to Home Source. We don't honor those requests and release students to Bethel so that Bethel can refer them to this program. However, should that change in the future, we believe these amendments are going to create further special exceptions for homeschooled students and create additional questions requiring clarification. And so we do have specific concerns about several of the amendments. The amendments call for the resident district to be responsible for the expense of student transportation. We're not clear, and it doesn't spell out whether that means that we'd be also responsible for the resident students who are currently attending Home Source from our district under the provisions of the 2007 legislation, which grandfathered students. If it includes them or future students, this would extend a benefit to homeschooled students that isn't even available to our current students in our school district who choose to attend a school outside their neighborhood or one of our magnet schools. They're responsible to provide their own transportation, but this bill would call for homeschooled students attending Home Source to require the resident district to be responsible for student transportation. Two, We're curious as to why both the resident district and the qualified district would become responsible for working with families to resolve issues. The draft amendments seem to indicate that both districts are responsible, which could lead to different opinions and an extended process to resolve a complaint. And in fact, that possibility came up with one of the families and students who had been grandfathered prior to 2007. The other complication for the resident district is that it is not responsible for monitoring the program, and so it would be very difficult for the resident district to respond to concerns. So we don't believe the resident district should have that responsibility once a student is referred. Three, the qualified district becomes responsible for examinations required under ORS 339.035 for instruction provided by Home Source. The bill is clear that parents are responsible for homeschooled progress being made when they're being homeschooled, but for the instruction taking place in Home Source, we're not clear who would be responsible for those results or student progress. The amendment doesn't clarify that. Four, the amendment calls for a release from other than for a release form other than an inter-district transfer form or agreement for Home Source students, and all other students who are being referred to other school districts use an inter-district transfer process, and so we don't believe that a separate process should be set up, a simple release for homeschooled students that could have fewer requirements and conditions for homeschooled students. And lastly, the amendments would expand the program by allowing siblings of students who were grandfathered prior to 2007 to automatically attend. And we believe that decisions about any additional students should be left to districts to decide, not the legislature. We want the right to first determine whether our district can meet the needs of students seeking alternative placements. We allow homeschooled students to attend our schools on a part-time basis. We offer a wide variety of programs, and we would like the opportunity to make the decision about siblings of these students. The supporters of SB 43 have said that they're seeking to clarify the responsibilities of the resident and sponsoring school district through this bill, but we do not believe, as I just testified, that they fully clarify the responsibility and could place additional financial burdens on our district should we decide at some point in the future to refer students. Thank you very much for your time, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. We'll go to Ms. Wolfmemer and hold questions until she's done.
Okay.
We have your written testimony.
Yes, Mr. Chair and committee members, for your record, Lori Wimmer from OEA, representing 48,000 educators in Oregon Public Schools and community colleges. We, too, participated on the work group in 2007 that yielded the compromise and agreed to it because it was a very contained exception in the law, because, after all, these are a private program receiving public dollars, and it's a part-time program, not a full-time program. And so we believe that that we came up with a compromise that was, I think, intended to include siblings. I think it was an oversight that, in our perspective, that the language left that out, and we said in the one work group meeting that was held this session that we would be amenable to including siblings if that clarification were needed. Our understanding of the problem that was brought up this session is a bit different from the one that was that I just heard explained by the maker of the bill. We were told that the department had some concerns about the clarification of roles among the districts, and
our hope was that that could be handled in a contract setting between the participating districts and home source rather than through state law, which would set that precedent. And while we're really appreciative of the proponents' efforts to soften some of their original ideas in Senate Bill 43, have also had some of our members in the Eugene area meet with those folks to see if they could come to some resolution on the parts that still gave us concerns. As of today's date, we had not yet been able to get to a place where we could agree to support the bill with the amendments that you have today. We'd like to see them continue to be worked so that we could have something we could support at this moment. It still includes things that give us concern. For example, the issue that was just raised about the inter-district agreement, that's the normal way that transfers from resident districts to another district where a student intends to take educational programs, that's how it's transacted. And so if a release form is identical to that, it seems to us to be unnecessary or redundant. If it does something different, it appears to be something of an end run around the inter-district transfer process, and if so, that seems to be a problem, creating yet another form, yet another process, another procedure, and if it's an end run around districts, that would seem to violate local control. And while I think that it's still left to the district to determine whether or not they wish to participate, That leads me to wonder why the inter-district form is in some way problematic. That's never been explained to us sufficiently. So those are some of the kinds of questions we've had, concerns we've had, and the reason we can't support the bill in this form at this point.
Questions of our panel? Okay, thank you both.
Thanks.
That's all we have signed up to testify on Senate Bill 43. We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 43, and then we will carry this one over. I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 935. Senate President Peter Courtney is here. Ms. Richardson, do you want
to? Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 935 requires the Office of Emergency Management to seek monies to create and implement a statewide first responder building mapping system. And the Dash 1 amendments before us would accompany the measure itself, and the Dash 1 amendments specify some of the information that the system may include. This measure does have a referral to Ways and Means. We do not have fiscal statements on it at this time.
Senator Courtney, thanks for being here today.
Chair Hass and Vice Chair Morris, Senator Bonamici, and Committee Administrator Dana Richardson.
I'm a co-sponsor.
And Senator Jeff Cruz. When Senator Virgil asked me to sign on to this, I immediately did so. I'll read a statement, then I'll tell you why I signed on to it. Actually, I shouldn't read the statement because I don't like to read, and you should have my statement anyway because I always like to read, leave behind, for what it's worth, a written statement to the extent that anybody reads them. This piece of legislation directs the Office of Emergency.
Senator
Bridger has stepped in. Oh, so that means I better stop.
No. Don't stop.
Well, it's your bill. You better go first. Here, you sit right in the middle and you start talking.
Yes, sir. I know. Chair Hass, members of the committee, I'm Joanne Verger representing District 5, and it's my pleasure to be here today to speak to you in support of Senate Bill 935. I want to just, you're going to get some copy passed out to you of my testimony, so I'm going to just talk to you a little bit about children and the safety of our children. We hear more and more about earthquakes and tsunamis, and the predictions get more dire. And it's very difficult to get the public to pay attention to that. It's so easy for us to say, look, this isn't going to happen in my lifetime. You know, 50 years, I'm not going to worry about it. But let me tell you that our schools and our buildings are not ready at all for this kind of disaster. And in my district, I have schools that are in the tsunami zone. Obviously, they need to be moved, but they do not have the capital construction money to move. And so the best thing that we can do is at least do the mapping of these buildings so that we will be able to tell where children are located in the building. And even in times when you're not having an emergency, such as an earthquake or a tsunami, it is very beneficial to have the mapping of buildings. There's an anecdotal story told about a young man who decided to close himself up in a chemistry lab and was going to do all kinds of disastrous things. And because they had the mapping of the building in the state of Washington, they were able then to locate him, to shut off the gas lines that went into that particular part of the building, and to save the lives of perhaps 2,000 students. And so while we need it for the earthquake, there are other reasons that we want to do the mapping of these buildings. This bill, obviously, is going to have a fiscal. So I would like Chair Haas to just suggest to you that the committee take into consideration some option, perhaps, that this stay on the radar, whether it's something in the interim that we can continue to not let this go away. We are in an emergency crisis right now, but we're not going to stay in it, and we cannot let the lives of our children go away. If something happens and we lose a lot of our schools and don't have the responders' information for them, I think we will all regret it. And so with that, I'll have you read my other testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Courtney, did you want to expand on that?
Thank you, Chair Haas. I think I've already personally addressed you as a committee. My name is Peter Courtney. I live at 2925 Island View Drive North here in Salem. I'm a state senator, and it's District 11. My testimony was written brilliant, and it would have been written had I been allowed to give it brilliant, but then Senator Verger came forward in a very spontaneous way, spoke better than me. I think basically what we're talking about here, and the reason I jumped at signing on to this bill, and I wish I'd thought of it, but I've been too focused on another part of the tsunami. This tells the Office of the Emergency Manager to come up with these plans, whereas if you're a first responder, you know where stairwells and where emergency meeting places are and evacuations plan, and you also would have a list of contact of emergency personnel. We've already told the Office of Emergency Management to come up with an evaluation of our schools, emergency building, to find out what their retrofit needs are. And that's one thing we're trying to do to get ready for the big quake, which is coming. This goes to floor plans and evacuation routes, which you've got to know, because there's going to be such confusion out there when this thing hits, that those who are in a first responder situation are going to need all the help they can to save lives, as an example of that was given by the good Senator Verger. I just want to say one last thing, and this is simply personal to me, not to you, Senator Verger, so I hope you'll allow me to say it, because you're very polite and you're very civil and you're very well-mannered. I just hope that, Senator Verger, you have a whole lot more luck with the Office of Emergency Management than I've had. So anyway, having made that remark for the record, I think this is a very good bill. It's a very important bill to get ready for the crisis. It's going to hit our states, going to hit our coast, and going to hit our valley. And so I thank the good Senator for introducing the bill, and I thank her also for allowing me to sign on. You have my written testimony, members of the committee.
Thank you both. Questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much, Senator Verger and Senator Courtney, for bringing this forward. Do you have any idea of the cost that may be involved to map, for example, a typical high school or typical elementary school or the state capitol, for example?
You know, I don't. The day that President Courtney and I went out to the school, do you remember what that total amount of money that they said it would be? I don't either. I just don't. I'm sorry, Senator Bonamici, that I don't have that number. It It certainly is going to carry a strong fiscal. I'm sure you know that.
Well, we were just given a note that that's coming down the hall, and we should have a number to answer that question, Senator.
Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah, I just asked Senator Pollack, my staff person who helps with this, and she says they don't have it yet, but I guess you've got it coming down the hall as we speak. The number that Senator Verger is referring to was at North Salem High School, and that involved the cost. They had identified a certain number of our schools that we need to retrofit. The condition is so bad. And as you know, we had the state of Oregon's people have said they will spend $1 billion to retrofit schools and emergency buildings. They said that in November 2002. And by the way, we haven't spent a single dime of it yet, and this is 2009. And that's where you got my anger about the Office of Emergency Management. We have not spent a single dime of $1 billion that the public said you should spend to immediately go in and retrofit schools, community colleges, colleges and universities, K through 12, high schools, as well as police and fire stations, as well as some hospitals to get ready for K through 9. But that's what that was that
that's
day
what,
right up
right.
here at
that's
North
right.
Salem High School. It was speaking to retrofit
retrofitting.
Costs. It was not speaking
and not
to, any
speaking
of
to
of
this. No, that's right. And certainly retrofitting even our public buildings, so many of them. I know that in Coos Bay, when I was the mayor, they came and did a number of buildings, and they told me that City Hall there would be the first building to go down.
That's why you came up here instead of
staying there. Yeah, I came to the Capitol to be safe.
Well, thank you, Senator Verger. I know this is near and dear to your heart, and Senator Courtney, I know from working with you in 2001 on those measures that this is.
Tell me.
$306,900 in this biennium.
That's what that is.
Well, that was $306 million, Mr. Chair.
You know, ordinarily, Mr. Chair, that would be funny, but it's not. So, by the way, if you want to see an extraordinary facility in terms of being built new, in terms of how you get ready for the 9.3 earthquake, you should go visit the Corvallis Fire Department. That building has been, I assume you know that, Senator Morris, very well done in terms of these kinds of issues. You're looking at us. I suppose that means we leave.
Well, no. You're welcome to stay.
Well, no, I really don't
I've
want
to. I've got Representative Matthews on deck. And
who is?
Representative Matthews.
And that's okay. Then I can leave. Is it so it's $300,000? Is that about it? It's $400,000. Could someone read to me what it is?
$306,979 plus $392,192.
Well, I know where this is going.
Senator Morris, is the language in the bill sufficient to receive federal funds? It just says when funds are available. Is that sufficient definition? I assume a project like this, there would be federal funding. Could be federal funding available. And is the language sufficient? That's my question.
I don't want to play, Chair Harris, I don't want to play smartest kid in the class, so I don't know. Obviously, you're talking FEMA, you're talking some of those kinds of monies.
Sure.
That's a very good question. I don't know. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Senator House, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Greg Matthews. I'm state representative for House District 50, the great city of Gresham. Here to testify on behalf and offer some support, of course, for Senate Bill 935. I think we've talked a little bit about the bill already. I came in a little late. Appreciate following such esteemed colleagues there. But the issue of seismic and whatnot isn't what I'm going to address, although I will say seismic studies have shown us that our fire stations are actually to the point where if we end up in some sort of a national or natural emergency, our first priority is move the rigs out of the stations because they are going to crumble down. We want to be able to respond. I want to address kind of in section two there, specifically from line 18 and then down to the bottom of the page, which is to do with more of a first responder and what this information would mean to us in the fire service. And again, it's just a brief background. I'm a former police officer as well. And during my time as a police officer, I was a member of the SWAT team for about 9 years. And so having responded and trained and been available to these sorts of events, and I'm thinking, of course, of the large emergencies, this information is actually critical to not only our safety, but more importantly, safety of the community, so that we can respond and activate appropriately. Pre-plans are nothing new to firefighters. We like to know where all the sprinkler systems are at and all the components of the building, the exits, the egress. Absolutely critical for us. Having a systematic study throughout the state would certainly help us in our response. And again, it's about, for us, it's about our safety so that we can protect our citizens' safety. But I do think it's critical in the planning phase and the response phase. And so I understand it's tough times, and the big question is, where does the money come from? That is a chore that, as you know, in both the House and the Senate, we have colleagues that are working extremely hard on that. But this issue to me is, it is important to community safety, ultimately important to our firefighter, first responder safety, police, military personnel, and everybody else. So I hope you can find it within yourselves to pass this forward and move this bill. It's a good bill, and it would mean a great deal to those first responders who are out there.
Appreciate that. Questions of Representative Matthews. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your opportunity. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Bob Livingston. Firefighters. Brothers in arms.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Bob Livingston, representing the Oregon State Firefighters Council. And like my colleague that just spoke, I too am a firefighter. I work for the City of Salem. However, my comments today will be on behalf of myself as a first responder as well as those of the Oregon State Firefighters Council. I really don't have a lot to add other than I know that a lot of attention was addressed on the large-scale emergency, and certainly mapping of those issues and to take off where Representative Matthews spoke about. If we could just step back a little bit, and if you remember where we were prior to enhanced 911, where when someone called 911, they'd have an emergency and you'd have to know the actual address. Well, today they don't even have to do that. It pops up on the screen, you know where it is. So really, in that respect, we have continue to make progress and keep in touch with where we are technologically. The fact of the matter is, today here in Oregon, the technology is available to have mapping and to have good three-dimensional drawings to know where, as Representative Matthews noted, where fire sprinklers are, where the fire department connections are, where the hydrants may be. All those things are invaluable when you're trying to effectuate an actual emergency, particularly at a large complex where there's a large life safety issue, such as a school. But I would like to also mention that one of the things and advantages that moving forward in some way or fashion, and at least making sure that we make progress in our technology to address these kind of things, this would also be of a benefit for a medical emergency or even a small-scale fire at a school. And let me give you an example. As you may be aware, think of your own high school or middle school where it's a fairly large complex. If you had a map and if you were in a, if let's use a cardiac arrest situation, and while I think you've done some good work with AEDs, large complex. I've had this experience before. You're not quite sure where it is on the complex, so you go to the front of the school only to find out that, well, you need to drive around the block and to the back of the school by the softball fields. With this technology that would be available, you would actually be able to say, hey, I don't need to go to the front of the address. I need to take this street that's a block away, and it would save you time. Rightfully so, I think it's not just about whether it's the tsunami or the earthquake. This would be day-to-day information that, in essence, would effectuate and give us a better opportunity to maybe change or alter the outcome of a medical emergency, a fire, or other related emergencies. So while we recognize and are very cognizant that these are tough economic times, I think the previous speakers spoke eloquently that we're hopeful that we can do something to continue to move forward on this for not only the safety of first responders, but more importantly to our citizens on these large-scale school complex. And with that, I'd be happy to take any questions that you may have and appreciate your time and effort, Mr. Chair and committee members.
Thank you. Questions, committee? Well, we appreciate your earnestness on this, and we have pretty much vetted this through here today, and we have a couple other witnesses, I think. Thank you, Bob. Ken Murray.
Good afternoon, Chair Haas and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ken Murphy. I'm the director of the Oregon Emergency Management, which is a division of the Oregon Military Department. And I will not read the testimony there that is being handed out. Just some issues with the bill, which this is the third legislative session that this building mapping system bill has come forward. And it's I agree with all the previous speakers. Clearly a much-needed system dealing with any type of event. You've heard natural disasters, terrorism, just about anything that you can possibly think about that you would need information on the interior or exteriors of facilities. But some of the comments that I made are to try and expand the bill. It did not take into account community colleges or the university systems. And also, it did not take into account leased or rented facilities by government-owned entities. So I, and as we've discussed, you know, the potential here is the bill talks about having my office seek the funding for it. The fiscal that I put in there was I do not have any employees currently that seek funding. We manage the grants that are given to us by Homeland Security or other agencies. And then I think also the second person there is to take a look at being able to see what's already out there, address the issues such as there's clearly some security issues of having this type of information with these detailed plans, and then also computer software, computer hardware. Many of our communities do not have the technology for their first responders, and I think it also advocates that there's other responders beyond police and fire that may this may be valuable to, such as public works and that type of issue that may roll upon a scene or a disaster that may need this information. So I think it's a good piece of legislation. It's clearly something that would move Oregon forward in its preparedness. And in the fiscal and in my estimation and working just with the Department of Administrative Services and looking at state agencies and the school systems, which were in excess of 4,000 buildings, we tried to take a look at those buildings that may already have some of this in place, all the way to the other end of the spectrum that they may not have anything in place. And looking at an average of about $10,000 per building, depending on the square footage, it could obviously go up or down. And then also some of the new technologies that not only provide a blueprint, but the technologies, and this was available quite a few years ago, where you have cameras that will photograph a 360-degree view of inside the building so that first responders can actually see the physical layout of it also. So with that, I will answer any questions you may have.
Mr. Murphy, did you bring these concerns to the sponsors?
I did not bring those to the sponsors.
Questions? Okay. Sounds like you might want to have a cup of coffee with the Senate President one of these days.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 935. It does have a fiscal, as you know, so I'll take a motion to move it to Ways and Means.
Can we move into a work session, Mr. Chair?
Yeah. I will open up a work session for Senate Bill 935.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 935.
Senator Morris moves to adopt the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 935. Discussion? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 935 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Senator Morse moves Senate Bill 935 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation that it be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Any discussion? Seeing none, any objection? Seeing none, Senate Bill 935 will go to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 935 and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 70.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 70 comes to you from the Department of Education, and we've got the measure and we have dash two amendments as well. The measure deals with students enrolled in hospital and long-term care or treatment programs, and it deals with the distribution of state school fund for the slots held by those students in those programs. And I'm happy to let the department kind of take it from there.
Okay, we got Morgan Allen, Eric Richards.
Chair Haas and members of the committee, for the record, Morgan Allen from the Department of Education, and joining me are Eric Richards and Steve Smith from our Office of Student Learning and Partnerships, and we're here today to ask for your support of Senate Bill 70 with the dash 2 amendments. It's still going to have probably quite a journey through this process, so we're hoping we can take that first step and get it moving today out of this committee. To give you just a little bit of background, as you know, the Department of Education is charged with providing educational services to children who are hospitalized with a physical or mental illness, or children who are placed into long-term care and treatment programs by the Department of Human Services, the Oregon Youth Authority, or county mental health agencies. And in the packet of testimony that's coming around, I've provided descriptions of the hospital programs. There are hospitals like Dornbrecher, Emmanuel, the Shriners Children's Hospital, and the Oregon State Hospital. I've also included the list of the 49 long-term care and treatment education programs that are currently operating throughout the state of Oregon. We contract with 29 different school districts and ESDs to deliver those services. So what we're here today is basically to ask for a revision to the state school fund statutes related to how we draw money out of the state school fund for these two programs. As you know, for about the last 15 years, the Department of Education has calculated the state school fund by using the number of beds or slots that would be needed to meet the needs of students during the biennium. During the current biennium, during the 07-09 biennium, our staff here, Mr. Smith to my left, discovered that the current statute does not allow for state school fund dollars to be drawn down in that manner. Current law only allows these payments to be drawn down based on ADM, or average daily membership. So, frankly, Mr. Chair, for about the last 15 years or so, the staff of the department have been incorrectly interpreting Oregon statute in regards to this funding source. So without a change to that statute, we're going to have a pretty drastic drop-off in funding for these school programs. So as you might imagine, each biennium, the caseload and funding projections for these are based on sort of historical caseload and the numbers that we get from people like DHS and OIA. So just very briefly, why the average daily membership or the ADM does not provide adequate funding for these programs. ADM is an average, and it assumes that you have a relatively stable student population. As you might imagine with these programs, we have lots of children coming and going depending on when their illness or when they get sick or when they're hospitalized or when they're placed into these long-term care and treatment programs by another state agency. And enrollments can fluctuate day by day, and ADM would not capture the true cost to run to keep these slots open for these kids. And the other big thing is to borrow from the previous testimony, it's sort of like a fire station. You don't really know how many fires you're going to have, but you need to have a fully staffed fire station ready to go when the fires do happen. And so for these programs, we need to have staff and programs in place for when the kids do show up, because they can show up at any time depending on when they're placed or when they're illness. So to sort of summarize a couple of things, I did include, there's a one-page sheet that should have came around with your testimony, and I know I've talked to all of the members of this committee a little bit about this, to sort of show the dramatic impact if we don't get this changed in statute, slots versus ADM. There should be a one-page little spreadsheet that came around with the testimony. And essentially, the way we have been drawing down this money during the last biennium, you would have gotten about $19 million for these two programs. And if we change to ADM, you'd see it drops down to under $11 million. So these programs would lose on average, over 40% of their funding from the state school fund. During the current biennium, for the record, we have been, during the current school year, excuse me, we have been drawing the money out of the state school fund correctly using ADM. And because we had some reserve funds and other funds at our disposal, no one has felt the pinch just yet. But if we don't change this statute and sort of allow the historical practice to continue, during the next biennium, we're going to have a drastic drop-off. So, again, I think that's something to be really clear. I know you have a revenue statement in there. We still contend this is revenue neutral. I talked to Mr. Meyer about this, and I think if he's listening, he would probably agree with me that what we're asking for is we're basically asking for the authority to continue drawing funding off the state school fund as we always have. We're not asking for a funding increase or more funding per student. We're just basically asking for that historical funding draw to continue. Again, if we don't change this during this biennium, we're concerned that a lot of the providers won't be able to provide this service. I know when I talked to members individually, they had a few questions. Senator Morris asked a good question about, whether we had empty hospital beds that we were paying for. And no, the answer to that is no. What we do is we have teaching staff and materials and resources on standby for when kids do end up in Dornbeck or Emmanuel or the Shriners Hospital so that they can continue their education while they're recovering from their illness and hopefully getting back to their regular schools. And Senator Cruz and I were talking about this a little bit yesterday, and just to kind of give you a perspective, Senator, kids, talking to our staff, kids can be in there year-round, 365 days a year. We have some kids that might be in just for a couple days, while they're getting the help that they need, for example, in a long-term care and treatment program. The important thing also is that I've talked to all of the major education groups in our state, COSA, OSBA, the Oregon Education Association, the School Employees Association. They're all supportive of the changes. They understand what we're trying to do. We don't know of any opposition to the bill. I will say that we have reviewed the Dash 2 amendment. It's going to need a little bit of tweaking through the process to make it just right, but we can surely do that, whether it goes to Ways and Means or Revenue or whether you choose to send it over to the House. I know the Senate President's Office will decide ultimately where it goes next, but we would be happy to answer any questions for you. I brought a couple burly gentlemen with me that will help answer your questions. You'll notice they're in dark suits, so they'll help me out of any trouble I might have, but we would be happy answering questions, and we appreciate you hearing this bill this session, and we encourage you to adopt the Dash 2 amendments today and move the bill along. It does not have a fiscal impact on the department.
$19 million. I realize this isn't a fixed number of students for a certain time, like in a conventional setting, but can you give us a ballpark number of kids who are served?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, actually, I can give you some ballpark numbers. For example, if you just give me a second to refer to some of my sheets, and Steve might have to help me. I know for the hospital program, during the 07-09 biennium, we had about 320 slots, so about 320 beds were sort of available at the various hospitals. Those beds or slots served over 3,200 children during the course of the biennium. And as far as the long-term care and treatment program, we had about 2,400 slots or 2,400 beds available, and I believe those programs serve several thousand children during the course of the biennium. So it's not an insignificant number of children. And again, we're talking about some of our sickest or children, and also some of our children with very severe mental health needs as well that end up in a lot of these programs. And Mr. Chair, just to go further, the state school fund is just one source of funding for these programs. The department receives grant and aid funding, general fund grant and aid to distribute to the contractors. We also receive IDEA funding for the kids that have special education needs, and there is some Title I monies available for some of these children as well. So it's three or four different pots of money going in to pay for these programs. So This would represent a pretty significant hit to the other funds, which are drawn down from the state school fund during the biennium.
Questions? Well, I appreciate your candor in telling us you were doing this wrong for so long. As my dad would say, at least you came forward and told the truth. We want to correct this, though, and we know there was nothing.
Mr. Chair, and just to note for the record, and we are doing it correctly for this school year, I believe. We are using the ADM figures, and we have been backfilling with reserve funds and stuff like that. So we are doing it right. But sort of given the magnitude of the monies at stake here and the fact that it's essentially revenue neutral in the sense that we're not asking for more money, and this is sort of how these long-term care and treatment providers and hospital programs have built their budgets over the years. It would just be too much of a hit to them in the short term if we change this, or if we didn't get this fixed.
Okay. Any other questions here? I'll do a little math on the side. So if you're looking at about 5,600 beds or students.
Well, I think, Mr. Chair, we could try to get you a more exacting number. I would say probably at least, for the hospital programs, at least 3,000 kids were served during the current, or are being served during the current biennium. For the long-term care and treatment programs, several thousand. Do we have a ballpark, Steve?
For the record, Steve Smith from the Oregon Department of Education. And we have a ballpark, probably on a yearly basis, the number of unique individual students that come through the long-term care and treatment programs is between 3,000 and 4,000. Students a year. That's our best estimate. And so over the course of a biennium, you're looking at 6,000 to 7,000 individual students. Some of them are there for very long periods of time. Some of them are there for short periods of time, and they come back to the programs. The main thing about this is that the decision on when to enter a student into the program and when to exit a student from the program is up to other state agencies. And our long-term care and treatment contractors have to be able to provide education for whoever happens to be there on any given day.
Okay. Do we have anyone else signed up to testify? If not, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 70 and open up a work session on Senate Bill 70.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the -2 amendments to Senate Bill 70.
Senator Morris moves to adopt the -2 amendments to Senate Bill 70. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 70 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Morris moves Senate Bill 70 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, the bill is moved to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. We're down at this end. Senator Bonamici, would you like to carry this?
I will. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And I will close the work session on Senate Bill 70. Moving through our list here, I will open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 344.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is a reprise of a tune that we've heard before regarding county surveyors and assessors. We did pass this measure out once before, but we've got it back with an A4 amendment that removes the requirement that county surveyors be elected and requires the county governing body to appoint county surveyors, allows county charters or county ordinances to provide otherwise. It removes the county surveyors from the recall provision. So you notice I never mentioned assessors,
yes,
which means the -2s would not apply in any way to assessors. We do not, let me get this right. We do not have fiscal statements on this at this time.
We do not.
And we've got folks here. And Eric, Commissioner
George. Okay. Well, Eric, Senator George's office, would you want to start off?
Hello, Chair, members of the committee. I'm Eric Wareham. I'm a legislative aide for Senator Larry George. Sends his regrets that he can't be here. The hazelnut industry is going nuts, apparently, so he's busy. So the amendment before us that we have, you guys have looked at this already several times, and I think the amendment that we have is trying to still lead in the direction of changing these technical positions that are currently elected to a more professional position. And I think Senator George feels that this still does that with just surveyors, and it's only going to apply to surveyors. There was some concern about assessors being involved, and Senator George agrees with that. So that's why we've pared down this amendment. And it still is going to give counties the flexibility to have elected surveyors if they feel it's necessary. And they can do that simply by creating a county ordinance. So a simple fix if they feel that it's going to be onerous on them in any way.
Okay. Questions? Senator Morris?
Mr. Chair, did we move on the floor to re-refer this
yes.
back to committee?
Yes.
Okay.
I did.
Thank you. I lost track of that.
Thank you, Eric.
All right. Thanks.
Tom Gallagher.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Tom Gallagher, representing the Professional Land Surveyors of Oregon. We were not involved in the first hearing on this bill. There were some county surveyors here, and I'm sorry to come up objecting to this particular amendment. My understanding, as this went along, was that the amendment would allow the county by ordinance to choose whether its surveyor was elected or appointed. The way the amendment reads is all elected surveyors are now unelected unless the county chooses to, by ordinance, to have them elected. My surveyors are probably the only people that work on a daily basis with a county surveyor and so forth. I understand the good governance part of this bill. It may not be in 2009 the best thing to have some of these minor offices elected. I appreciate and sat through the hearing before and appreciated the discussions of the committee. I tend to agree with that. But what we're doing right now is we're taking about half of the county surveyors who are elected, and we're taking them out of office and unless the county goes through an ordinance to put them back in. We could agree to an amendment, and this is what I told Senator George and the chair earlier. We could agree to an amendment that simply gave the authority to the county to decide how to do it by ordinance rather than going through a county charter amendment or a home rule charter. So what we are objecting to here is simply unelecting a large number of county surveyors in that process. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Melissa Unger. Melissa, would you push those a little bit? There you go.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Haas and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Melissa Unger, and I represent the Service Employees Union, Local 503. We represent workers at the state and local government levels, and they have asked me to come testify on this bill, and I will be honest, I'm probably not an expert. But they do have, their opinion is that they would like to see both county surveyors and county assessors appointed unless otherwise determined through a county ordinance or a county charter. So we do support that piece of the amendment, but they do support both. They believe that it's very technical decisions and adjustments that these directors make, and that they're best appointed by the county commission instead of by elected through the process. So I just wanted to put that out there on these amendments, and that's we don't support taking out the county assessors. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you. You do not have the appropriate fiscal or revenue paperwork here if we were to move it today, so I'm going to close this public hearing on Senate Bill 344.
Mr. Chair, while we're at it, would you like to carry that bill over?
I would like to carry over 344. I'm sorry. So, moving down our list. I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 916.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Senate Bill 916 requires county budgets. Well, actually, I'm sorry, let's focus on the Dash 3 amendments for this, although it does carry forward some of the provisions. So I'll do a little combo to give you a feel for what the discussion's about. It requires county budgets to contain a summary of revenues and expenditures for specified major programs that are funded in part by state resources. And it specifies that the summary must include revenues and expenditures in the adopted budget, the previous year's budget, and actual revenue and expenditure data from the previous 2 months. It reduces the amount of time for which a governing body may change the fee from 1 year to 6 months. And I hope that gives you a flavor. I'm sure additional testimony will as well. We have fiscal and revenue statements before us on the Dash 3.
Okay. We have a panel before us. Whoever wants to start. Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Janet Carlson, Marion County Commissioner. I was appointed late last year by Commissioner Linda Madrell, who serves as President of the Association of Oregon Counties, to co-chair the Governance Steering Committee of AOC. This bill came forward out of discussions in the Governance Committee. The county administrators are one of the affiliate groups that reports to the Governance Committee. And a lot of the driver behind this bill, although there are a number of technical changes that are described in the handout that's coming around, is a bill called Senate Bill 5520 that came out in 2005, I believe. Then-Senator Kurt Schrader and Representative Susan Morgan, and you can see in the one of the handouts that I've provided that's black and white here, asked the Association of Oregon Counties to work with the Legislative Fiscal Office to start trying to delineate how much money the counties are putting into some of the programs that the state also contributes to, and so how are we partners in that shared services system? And I know you've seen that multicolored sheet that Gordon Foltz and others carry around in their hip pocket to illustrate those services. The colored copy that is in your handout shows the results of that 5520 project, and it's got some charts that show in bright red colors the county general fund at that particular time that went into those services. It was not a small task coming up with those charts. It looks like it's a real easy thing to just draw the pie charts, but this thick one was a survey that took us, I'm trying to think, somewhere between 3 and 4 months, I think, to pull together the survey, and then a few more months to get the data together, and then phone calls and follow-up and emails and all kinds of machinations trying to figure, get apples to apples as we were preparing these budgets. We believe at the Association of Oregon Counties that we are partners. We also believe that counties are in some ways a different animal from other municipal governments and special districts in that many of our services are services that we deliver at the local level for the state. And in essence, it's much like asking the state to choose, so what, you know, what's your priority, education or public safety or, you know, human services? We do all of those things, and we do those also at the county level. And we want those budgets to be transparent, and we want it to be so that the public can understand where their tax dollars are going. So with that in mind, we took our, John Krosick, who will testify in a few moments, took our ideas and got a note from Senator Morris, who we very much appreciate his assistance with this, and came up with Senate Bill 916. And then, lo and behold, we discovered that the special districts and some of the other governments, just the way that the language is structured in the statute, it becomes difficult to kind of unravel and say, well, this part's just for counties and these other parts are just for cities and special districts. We held a meeting that included the Department of Revenue and representatives of those other organizations. They are happy with the Dash 3 amendment that you see before you. I believe Ann has a letter of support from the League of Cities, and she's checked in with the special districts, and the Department of Revenue has also sent us a written notice, and they told us verbally also that they're fine with the Dash 3 amendments. We pulled back on a number of the more controversial provisions, and one of those is the idea that we can budget by program or fund. We're going to have that discussion in the interim, and the Department of Revenue has agreed to convene us to be able to continue that work so that we can figure out how to structure the language in a way that it meets their need, meets our need as counties, meets the needs of the other municipalities, and I think in the long run meets the need of the citizens to understand again where those revenues are being spent for services for the people. All right, so I think with that I'll turn it over to John Krosick, and he can give you the technical side of the bill.
Thank you, Senator Haas, members of the committee. If you have the sheet in front of you that has AOC on top and the bullet points, I'll just work through those quickly to tell you what each of the implications of those changes are. Commissioner Carlson spoke to the issue of the 55.
Could you start with your name, please?
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is John Krosick. I'm the budget officer for Yamhill County. If you look at the bullet points there on the AOC document, we'll start off with the first change, which relates to the 5520 project. This last time we tried to do this effort, we attempted to go through each county's budget and look at it department by department and try to determine what their expenditures were for each of the 5520 services. What we discovered is there are 36 counties and 36 different ways of doing a budget and 36 different ways of organizing your county. So that has proved a very difficult process to try to get that data together. This will greatly simplify and produce a less costly method of assembling that data. And it will be done at budget time when county budget officers and financial people are actually have this data right in front of them and can easily pull it together, or it can be also be done electronically. The next change in here allows changes to fees to occur every 6 months, comes out of a catch-22 situation that Deschutes County found itself in. Deschutes County had a practice of annually updating its fees and charges, so it had gone ahead and done so. Then one of the state agencies which supervises building activities in the counties had some objection to their fee schedule and ordered them to change it. The problem was there's this limitation on not being able to change it more than once a year. So they found themselves in this situation. They're being ordered by a state agency to make a change, but they can't legally make the change because they've already made a change. So this would correct that situation and allow those changes to be made more frequently. The next one is just a housekeeping issue. Current local budget law refers to street address. This would allow those local government entities that mail their summary publications of their budget to the cities as opposed to putting it into the newspaper, which is generally a fairly small district, to use post office box and rural route numbers as addresses along with street addresses. The next two, increase flexibility to transfer appropriations and remove the prohibition to transfer appropriations, are really speaking to the same issue. And in this case, most counties right now use an accrual or modified accrual basis of accounting, which means that when you're getting toward the end of the year, you may make a purchase or have a service that is delivered during the month of June, but you don't receive the invoice or the bill for it until July or sometimes even August. So as a consequence, most counties have to go through a process of defensive appropriations transfer to make sure that there is adequate appropriation authority in each of their funds and in each of their departments so that they don't overexpend their appropriations. The difficulty is transfers of appropriation authority can only be currently made out of the general fund. They cannot be made between special revenue funds. So this bill would remove that prohibition against moving appropriation authority between special revenue funds. Now, we're not talking about moving dollars. It's simply the authority to spend those dollars that would become transferable. The next bullet point increases the time period for repayment of an interfund loan from 5 to 10 years. Right now, for capital purposes, a county can borrow money between funds for a period of 5 years. That is sufficient for the purchase of equipment, such as a road grader, but it is not a sufficient time period when you're doing building improvements or activities such as that. So this would simply give the counties more flexibility to borrow their money from some of their reserve funds that don't have an immediate need for the money or even a moderate-term need for those dollars, as opposed to having to go out and use full faith and credit obligations or certificates of participation to borrow that money. In those cases, there are costs associated with those borrowing processes, and they can be fairly significant. Lastly, apply the reasonable person standard to estimating revenues and expenditures. Right now, local budget law simply states that has some prohibitions on activities that could not be foreseen. There's no particular standard in there, so it creates a lot of defensive budgeting and, frankly, creates budgets that appear larger than they really intend to be. This would add the reasonable person standard so that it could not be reasonably foreseen, and I think that would eliminate some fear on the parts of budget officers that they're going to wind up responsible for an activity that they couldn't, within their imagination, foresee. So with that, we're all prepared to take your questions.
Excellent summary. Thank you, John. Anne, did you?
No, just to say that AOC does support this bill. It's important to update the law. Anne Hannes. I guess it's late on a Friday. Anne Hannes, Association of Oregon Counties. It's well overdue to update the law that's antiquated. The local budget law, it's a dry subject, but it's also an important one to be able to have a system that's going to be operational, that will allow the local governments to do their job and to be really transparent for citizens. So this starts us on the pathway to make some really good changes, and we hope to come back with you with more changes using a consensus process for the next session.
Questions? Senator Morris, this is your bill.
Thank you. Do you have any sense of the other than just a better database of any savings that would accrue to local government mm-hmm. by making these changes?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, I think the area that we could probably look at some significant savings would be in extending that period of time to borrow between funds, because the last time I had to go outside of the county to borrow money through a full faith and credit obligation, I think there was about a 1.5% charge to the underwriters that it cost us in order to market those bonds and get them sold. So that amounted to several thousand dollars that we spent that if we had this flexibility at that time, we would not have had to incur.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, in Marion County right now, just this week, we were looking at some options. We have an air quality issue out at our work center. If we use an interfund loan transfer, but we can only do that for 5 years, we get a much lower percentage rate than we do if we go outside and have to pay the full amount. We just pay what it would be for the investment rate in the local government investment pool, with what we would receive in earnings on that as a payment of interest back to that fund, as opposed to kind of the commercial rates that you have to get when you do other kind of lending.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you all.
Thank you very much.
And John Phillips from Department of Revenue. Property tax extraordinaire. Out of context here in the Education Committee today.
A little bit. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Phillips with the Oregon Department of Revenue. And the Department of Revenue does oversee statutorily the Local Budget Law Act. So we provide forms, review levies that are certified to the county assessors based on the roughly 1,400 taxing districts' budgets. So we've been involved in this bill. The dash threes are workable. The counties have raised some reasonable ideas and that can work for all districts, I think. And we'd like to work more in the interim on dealing with more of the other archaic issues in the Act. And that's my testimony. And I'm going to answer any questions. I'd be happy to.
Questions, Mr. Phillips?
Thank you.
Close public hearing on Senate Bill 916, and I will open up a work session on Senate Bill 916. All the appropriate fiscal revenue reports are in.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the dash three amendments to Senate Bill 916.
Senator Morris moves to adopt the dash three amendments to Senate Bill 916. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 916 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris moves Senate Bill 916 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Senate Bill 916 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Senator Morris, would you like to carry this?
That'd be fine. Would you like to? Yes, thank you.
You are the sponsor?
Yeah. Well, I'm a facilitator there, just helping the county.
Okay. All right, we're down into the nitty-gritty work sessions here. Where are we? We're open up a work session on Senate Bill 72.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is a bill that was before the committee last week, and we adopted the Dash 1 amendments at that time. This has to do with taking ESDs out of the definition of the provision of special education service statute. So, as I say, we did adopt the Dash 1s. We have a revenue statement indicating there's no revenue impact and that there is a minimal fiscal impact.
Okay. There you go, Mr. Chair.
Ready to go.
I move Senate Bill 72 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris moves Senate Bill 72 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion?
Just to clarify, I'm sorry, we did
Senator
adopt Hunter, the dash?
Yes.
Okay.
Seeing none, is there objection? Seeing none, measure passes. Senate Bill 72 will go to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
My turn.
Cruz.
Okay.
And I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 72. And we will carry over Senate Bill 767. We will carry over Senate Bill 652. And where are we at 537? We have
we're all set to go on that, Mr. Chair.
Okay, we will open up a work session on Senate Bill 537.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is a bill that the Chalkboard Project in COSA talked with us about with regard to setting up a mechanism whereby funding could be sought to audit and evaluate school districts on a voluntary basis. And I've got a motion for you.
We didn't have the
when we had this before, we did not have the fiscal, but we do at this time.
Did we adopt the amendments before? Or
we did not.
Okay.
Okay. Can we take just a minute to look at the fiscal?
To look at the fiscal?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, if I read the fiscal. Sounds like ODE has been doing what the bill would give them authority to do.
For voluntary audits.
Contemplating.
Okay. I think we do have one of this authors in the audience, Cindy Robert. Would you like to help clarify?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Cindy Robert with the Chalkboard Project. Excuse my casualness. I work at the school on Fridays, and I just came up to be at this hearing. I'm actually not sure what fiscal impact statement you're looking at and what it says. It's causing concern, but I do think that maybe we made this a little bit more difficult than it should have been last week. Very simply, the Best Business Practices Advisory Committee that you put into statute in 2007 only works with the Department of Education and the Secretary of State, and we're just asking that they be opened up to work with others like Chalkboard and the Oregon Association of School Business Officials.
Well, I think Senator Morris is looking at the first sentence and the second paragraph.
Okay.
It says the ODE can spend up to $800,000 in state school funds per biennium to contract with the Secretary of State for voluntary audits of district best practices.
Morgan, come on up. He was itching to get up here, Mr. Chair.
Was he?
Mr. Chair, for the record, Morgan Allen with the Department of Education. In last session, this legislative body chose to give the department the authorization to take $800,000 off the top of the state school fund in perpetuity until the legislature decides to change that policy. So that's not a new appropriation. That is money. It was, I believe, in House Bill 3141, there was a whole package of bills that included TAG, the audits, and about four or five other things where the legislature made a conscious policy decision to take the expenditures for those programs off the top of the state school fund, and the District Best Business Practices Advisory Committee was one of those things on that menu. So that's not a new appropriation.
And worse.
And it looks to me like what we're expanding is not just an audit, but an evaluation, which is a different form of benchmarking best practices. And as I recall the testimony, I think it was very compelling that this was the right thing to do. So.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, yes, again, this is an evaluation. It doesn't cost as much. It doesn't take as much time, but it serves a very good purpose in helping schools improve their best business practices. Secondarily, what you heard at the hearing was that perhaps this money that was appropriated into perpetuity would not be realized in the next biennium. So there would be no money to continue with the audits. And perhaps if we opened up the possibility of different relationships with the Secretary of State, the Department of Education, and other programs that cost less money, perhaps we could continue doing something like this at a lower price funded by private entities.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt. Are you ready?
Yes.
Okay. I move to adopt the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 537.
Senator Morris moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 537. Any discussion? Seeing none. So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 537 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris moves Senate Bill 537 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none. Any objection? Seeing none. So ordered, Senate Bill 537 will go to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I believe it's my turn. I will carry that bill. And I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 537. And where are we?
Come back there.
And I'll open up a work session on Senate Bill 637, Integrated Pest Management, the revenue and fiscal paperwork is now with us.
On the dash sixes, yes, Mr. Chair.
Do you have any comments?
Dana? I'm happy to refer to Senator Bonamici with regard to the changes in the dash sixes.
I'd be happy to discuss those or explain those, Mr. Chair. The Dash 6 amendment, I worked with basically with the Department of Agriculture on that. They were concerned about the scope of their responsibility in light of these difficult budget times under the former version of the bill. They'd been involved in the work group over the past a little more than a year. And what I decided to do after consulting with them in the Dash 6 amendments is to take out some of the administration by this Department of Agriculture. They are still involved in the licensing because when using integrated pest management, if they need to use a pesticide, then under the bill they have to have the appropriate license, and so there may be some additional school employees who need to get licensed, and that is done through the Department of Agriculture. But there was a provision in the prior version that referred to the Department of Agriculture administering the act. After talking with them and the proponents from the school communities, we thought rather than have administration and enforcement in this bill, it would be important. It does not go into effect until 2012. It would be important to get what we could passed this session so that the school districts can begin doing the research, learning about integrated pest management. There's a lot of information out there already. As you heard from the people we've been working with at Oregon State University, they did get a grant. They have a person who's already part-time working on integrated pest management for schools, so they'll start working on the model plans. And one other change that we did, although it might have been in the Dash 5s, was we took the Department of Agriculture out of the rulemaking on what constitutes a low-impact pesticide. So one of the things we heard from the school districts is that they wanted some clarity. So we have a process where they can first refer to the label on the pesticide product and then use a list that can, after considering certain factors and EPA designations on pesticides. And we decided that Portland, for example, already has a list. I want to make clear for the record that any district would be free to use a list that's already established using the standards that are set forth in the bill. So those are some of the changes. The primary reason for making the Dash 6 changes was after talking with the Department of Agriculture, they were concerned about the extent of their work and that was required under the prior version. And rather than see this bill not go forward because of that amount of responsibility. We wanted to get past what we could to begin the process. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, and our hat is off to you for being flexible and zigging and zagging your way through this to make it come out without a fiscal and still effective.
Thank you. And I did want to clarify, there's one thing, and I just got this fiscal when I got to this committee today. There's something on the first page in the last line of the first paragraph. I just want to clarify. It says, newly established schools are not subject to the provisions of this measure. That's not exactly what it means. There was a former provision that said newly established schools that have to report to the Department of Agriculture. I mean, they'll still need to comply with the provisions, but they don't need to report to the Department of Agriculture. So I just want to clarify that's on the fiscal.
Okay.
And you'll note on the second page that there is, because the licensing does involve a fee, it will generate other funds, so it pays for itself in that regard.
Other comments?
Mr. Chairman, just as a general comment, this is a mandate that has value. I don't question that. But we will be entertaining mandate relieving measures in a bill replacement in Senate Bill 441 for this next biennium. So on the one hand, we will pass something mandating certain things, and hopefully we'll have a thoughtful discussion next week on mandate relieving measures to help us get through this crisis that we're in. So I just want to point that out. There'd be a little bit of inconsistency possibly in our actions.
Appreciate that, Senator Morrison. Have been, of course, in these difficult times, very concerned about that. But after serving on the work group and hearing the testimony and doing the research, there's a tremendous amount of research about integrated pest management, have found that many districts have found it cost-effective. And with the EPA requirement coming into effect in 2015, it's inevitable anyway. This is already recommended by the EPA. It's considered to be best practices by a lot of even pesticide applicators now. And so I believe that it's something that, even though it seems like a mandate, it's something that the schools will be doing anyway and when the EPA requirement goes into effect. And with the 2012 implementation date, that'll give us a chance to have more discussion about it as we go forward.
Senator Cruz.
Thank you. I want to thank Senator Bonamici for also the adjustment on the signage, which I think was appropriate, and to just say warning, without a lot of the detail, because the question is, I'm not sure what a third grader could read, but I'd just like to say, Mr. Chair, that as a licensed applicator myself, it's a fairly extensive training program already in existence through the Department of Ag, and to go through that, one of the things they teach you in there is to read the label, and for most of these chemicals, if you follow label directions, you're doing safety. Some of the anecdotal stuff we heard in committee was about people using products that are only labeled for outside use inside. I would call that stupidity. But so if we have appropriately trained people following the labels the way they should, I think this will be very successful.
Thank you.
Some of the labeling I see says harmful if swallowed. And I always wonder.
With most of these products, what you get with it is it's in a little packet on the container, and it's several pages of where it can be used, how it can be used, what it's good for. I mean, it is very, very detailed anymore. So,
Mr. Chair, I was just looking through some of my notes. I have many files on this issue, but there was an International Integrated Pest Management Symposium in Portland just in March last month of this year, and there was a separate section and discussion about school integrated pest management, and they sent out following that, I'm getting some briefings on those. There's a whole discussion on developing the strategic plan for integrated pest management for all schools by 2015, which is what the EPA is working on. So I think this is going to put us ahead of the curve, and as we heard in the discussion in the other hearing that we had on this, the health impacts, particularly, it's not just the decrease of exposure to pesticides, but it's also the decrease in exposure to allergens, and the toxicologists and people I've been working with talk about how they've seen a decrease in childhood asthma and that type of thing once integrated pest management is implemented. So I can see some health benefits and cost savings in that regard as well.
Okay. Senator Moore. Senator Metzger.
Just one serious comment, and I do appreciate Senator Bonham. I mean, she's worked on this, and I wasn't sure about it when we first heard it. Although I always like the goal, but I think the work that you've done on it is very good. I feel very comfortable with it, and it certainly is the direction that is appropriate. But I would like to clarify for the record that it is not integrated pests management. It's integrated pest management, just in case anybody were wondering.
You said this was a service.
Pests. No, integrated. They're not integrated pest management.
Oh.
It's integrated
pest management. Clear that.
You know, that does clarify for me.
Yeah.
Thank you, Senator. I was confused.
Just in case.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 6 amendments to Senate Bill. What is it we're doing?
637.
Senator Morris moves the Dash 6 amendments to Senate Bill 637. Discussion? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 637 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Morris moves Senate Bill 637 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Senate Bill 637 will go to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Senator Bonamici, would you like to carry this?
I would, thank you.
Mr. Chair, just a question in respect
close
to 7.
Close session on 637.
Okay. Excuse me. Thank you.
Yep.
767, do we have any amendments?
Yes.
Yes.
Some of them.
They went out to your offices just before you probably came down here.
Yeah, okay. They were coming out while we were in there, too.
Okay.
Dash.
Gazillion. 16 and 17.
We're still in double figures.
That's not bad.
So that is a good segue into saying we touched 11 bills here today. We will have a similar agenda on Monday. So that probably requires some homework over the weekend.
Bring her dinner.
You never know.
Right.
Maybe dinner, but probably not a sleeping bag.
Okay.
I hope. No,
Mr. Chair, let's just make sure that if we're going for a marathon, that we aren't attempting to compete with Representative Greenlick's Monday evening marathon.
Is that my thought? He's doing that tonight.
No, that's Monday.
Mr.
Night.
Chair, did you want to see if Senator Metzger wanted to vote on Senate Bill 7?
Yes, I did. Yes, you've got the bill. I will ask for unanimous consent to allow Senator Metzger to vote on Senate Bill 70. Objection?
Does he have a good excuse, Mr. Chair?
Excuse me. Senator Metzger, how do you vote on Senate Bill 70?
Aye.
Metzger votes aye.
Okay.
Okay. We know the business. We are adjourned.
Have a good weekend.